Chapter 42.
"Look, Jim," Helen said, "this is one engagement we can't be late for. Old Mrs. Hodgson is an absolute pet. She'd be terribly hurt if we let her supper spoil." I nodded. "You're right, my girl, that mustn't happen. But I've only got 3 calls this afternoon, and Tristan's doing the evening. I can't see anything going wrong." This nervousness about a simple action like going out for a meal might be incomprehensible to the layman, but to vets and their wives, it was very real, particularly in those days of 1 or 2 man practices. The idea of somebody preparing a meal for me, then waiting in vain for me to turn up, was singularly horrifying, but it happened to all of us occasionally. It remained a gnawing worry whenever Helen and I were asked out, especially to somebody like the Hodgsons. Mr. Hodgson was a particularly likeable old farmer, short-sighted to the point of semi-blindness, but the eyes which peered through the thick glasses were always friendly. His wife was just as kind, and she had looked at me quizzically when I visited the farm 2 days ago. "Does it make you feel hungry, Mr. Herriot?" "It does indeed, Mrs. Hodgson. It's a marvellous sight." I was washing my hands in the farm kitchen and stealing a glance at the nearby table, where all the paraphernalia of the family pig-killing lay in their full glory. Golden rows of pork pies, spare ribs, a mound of newly made sausages, jars of brawn. Great pots were being filled with lard, newly rendered in the fireside oven. She looked at me thoughtfully. "Why don't you bring Mrs. Herriot round one night and help us eat it?" "Well, that's most kind of you, and I'd love to, but, now then, no buts," she laughed. "You know, there's far too much stuff here. We have to give so much away." This was quite true. In the days when every farmer and many of the townsfolk of Dalaby kept pigs for home consumption, killing time was an occasion for feasting. The hams and sides were cured and hung up, but the masses of offal and miscellaneous pieces had to be eaten at the time, and though farmers with big families could tackle it, others usually passed delicious parcels round their friends, in the happy knowledge that there would be a reciprocation in due course. "Well, thanks, Mrs. Hodgson," I said. "Tuesday evening, then, 7 o'clock? And here I was on Tuesday afternoon, heading confidently into the country with the image of Mrs. Hodgson's supper hanging before me, like a vision of the promised land. I knew what it would be. A glorious mixed grill of spare ribs, onions, liver and pork fillet, garlanded with those divine farm sausages which are seen no more. It was something to dream about. In fact, I was still thinking about it when I drew into Edward Wiggins' farmyard. I walked over to the covered barn and looked in at my patients, a dozen half-grown bullocks resting on the deep straw. I had to inject these fellows with blackleg vaccine. If I didn't, it was a fair bet that one or more of them would be found dead, due to infection with the deadly Clostridium, which dwelt in the pastures of that particular farm. It was a common enough disease, and stockholders had recognised it for generations, and had resorted to some strange practices to prevent it, such as running a seton, a piece of twine or bandage, through the dewlap of the animal, but now we had an efficient vaccine. I was thinking I'd be here for only a few minutes, because Mr. Wiggins' man, Wilf, was an expert beast catcher. Then I saw the farmer coming across the yard, and my spirits sank. He was carrying his lasso. Wilf, by his side, rolled his eyes briefly heavenwards when he saw me. He, too, clearly feared the worst. We went into the barn, and Mr. Wiggin began the painstaking process of arranging his long white rope while we watched him gloomily. He was a frail little man in his 60s, and had spent some years of his youth in America. He didn't talk a lot about it, but everybody in time gained the impression that he had been a sort of cowboy over there, and indeed he talked in a soft Texan drawl, and seemed obsessed with the mystique of the ranch and the open range. Anything to do with the Wild West was near to his heart, and nearest of all was his lasso. You could insult Mr. Wiggin with many things, and he wouldn't turn a hair, but question his ability to snare the wildest bovine with a single twirl of his rope, and the mild little man could explode into anger. And the unfortunate thing was that he was no good at it. Mr. Wiggin had now got a long loop dangling from his hand, and he began to whirl it round his head as he crept towards the nearest bullock. When he finally made his cast, the result was as expected. The rope fell limply halfway along the animal's back and dropped onto the straw.
"Tarnation!" said Mr. Wiggin,
and started again. He was a man of deliberate movements, and there was something maddening in the way he methodically assembled his rope again. It seemed an age before he once more advanced on the bullock with the rope whirring round his head.
"Booger it!"
Wilf grunted as the loop end lashed him across the face. His boss turned on him.
"Keep out of the dad blasted road, Wilf," he said querulously. "I gotta start again now."
This time he didn't even make contact with the animal, and as he retrieved his lasso from the straw, Wilf and I leant wearily against the wall of the barn. Yet again the whiz of the rope, and a particularly ambitious throw which sent it high into the crisscross of beams in the roof, where it stuck. The farmer tugged at it several times in vain.
"Gol darn it, it's got round a nail up there. Slip across the yard and fetch a ladder, Wilf."
As I waited for the ladder, then watched Wilf climbing into the shadowy heights of the barn, I pondered on Mr. Wiggin. The way he spoke, the expressions he used, were familiar to most Yorkshire folk since they filtered continually across the Atlantic in films and books. In fact, there were dark mutterings that Mr. Wiggin had learnt them that way, and had never been near a ranch in his life. There was no way of knowing. At last, the rope was retrieved, the ladder put away, and the little man went into action once more. He missed again, but one of the bullocks got its foot in the loop, and for a few moments the farmer hung on with fierce determination as the animal produced a series of piston-like kicks to rid itself of the distraction. And as I watched the man's lined face set grimly, the thin shoulders jerking, it came to me that Mr. Wiggin wasn't just catching a beast for injection. He was roping a steer. The smell of the prairie was in his nostrils, the cry of a coyote in his ears. It didn't take long for the bullock to free itself, and with a grunt of,
"Ornery critter,"
Mr. Wiggin started again. And as he kept on throwing his rope ineffectually, I was uncomfortably aware that time was passing, and that our chances of doing our job were rapidly diminishing. When you have to handle a bunch of young beasts, the main thing is not to upset them. If Mr. Wiggin hadn't been there, we would have penned them quietly in a corner, and Wilf would have moved among them and caught their noses in his powerful fingers. They were thoroughly upset. They had been peacefully chewing the cud or having a mouthful of hay from the rack, but now, goaded by the teasing rope, were charging around like racehorses. Wilf and I watched in growing despair as Mr. Wiggin, for once, managed to get a loop round one of them, but it was too wide and slipped down and round the body. The bullock shook it off with an angry bellow, then went off at full gallop, bucking and kicking. I looked at the throng of frenzied creatures milling past. It was getting more like a rodeo every minute. And it was a disastrous start to the afternoon. I had seen a couple of dogs at the surgery after lunch, and it had been nearly 2:30 when I set out. It was now nearly 4 o'clock, and I hadn't done a thing. And I don't think I ever would have, if fate hadn't stepped in. By an amazing fluke, Mr. Wiggin cast his loop squarely over the horns of a shaggy projectile as it thundered past him, the rope tightened on the neck, and Mr. Wiggin on the other end flew gracefully through the air for about 20 feet till he crashed into a wooden feeding trough. We rushed to him and helped him to his feet. Badly shaken but uninjured, he looked at us.
"Doggone, I just couldn't hold the blame thing," he murmured. "Reckon I better sit down in the house for a while. You'll have to catch that pesky lot yourselves."